Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, one of the hosts of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Thomas Patton about his recent book, The Buddha's Wizards, Magic, Protection, and Healing Burmese Buddhism, published by Columbia University Press in 2018. This book examines the Waitza, a figure in Burmese Buddhism who is possessed with extraordinary supernatural powers, usually gained through some sort of esoteric practice. Like the tantric adept in certain other Buddhist traditions, the Waitza can use his skills both to manipulate human affairs in the present world and to help people progress towards Buddhist soteriological goals. The Waitza is thus a morally ambiguous figure, for while this Buddhist wizard might heal a sick relative or help one's karmic circumstances, he might just as well cast an evil spell. Indeed, it is precisely because of the Waitza's perceived power that these wizards and their devotees have been persecuted by both the government and Buddhist monastic leaders, and why this tradition has largely existed at the margins of state-sanctioned orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Patton shows that while prototypes for this Buddhist wizard can be found in Burmese Buddhism in pre-modern times, the Waitza as we know him really emerges during the twilight of the 19th and the first half of the 20th centuries. Like many other Buddhists of this time, the Waitza were dismayed by the presence of the British in Burma, which they saw as a direct threat to Buddhism, and they used their supernatural powers to fight the British in whatever ways they could. Later, after the British left, and once it was seen that Buddhism was not in decline, Waitza shifted their focus from protection to propagation of Buddhism. To this end, they built pagodas not only throughout Burma, but also in faraway lands such as the United States. These pagodas were supposed to transmit the power of the Waitza with whom they were associated, and many Waitza devotees likened them to nodes in an electricity grid or even to Wi-Fi hotspots. While Patton locates Waitza within the aforementioned historical framework, much of his book is more concerned with the relationship between Waitza and devotee, and is based on both historical records and his extensive fieldwork. As noted, Waitza can use their powers for soteriological ends, but more often than not, they are found healing the sick. Not only that, but the majority of their beneficent activity occurs after they have died. Indeed, most people who meet a Waitza meet him not during his lifetime, but rather in a dream or semi-conscious state years after his death. In addition, Waitza are known to possess young women and help the living through these mediums, and Patton has a wonderful chapter on this phenomenon, in which he explores the ways in which this Waitza possession is different from other types of possession found in Buddhism. The book also looks at the process by which certain figures came to be prominent Waitza. The most famous Waitza, a man by the name of Boming Guan, who died in 1952, was said to have acted in a most bizarre manner. His speech was often incomprehensible, he would shout like a madman, and he was even known to have hurled his own feces at devotees. After his death, legends about this man and reports of encounters with him accumulated to the point that his saintliness, supernatural powers, and continuing protection of the living were indisputable. And yet his persona was in large part a posthumous development. Listeners with knowledge of the saint figure and other Buddhist or religious traditions will be particularly interested in this section. Patton makes a point of discussing the Waitza within a larger religious studies context. He draws extensively on the work of the scholar of American religion and Catholicism Robert Orsi, for example, and he contrasts the dream encounter rhetoric that he discovered in Burma with a tradition of dream interpretation found in certain forms of Islam. In the interview, we just scratched the surface, and listeners wanting to know more will have to read the book in order to appreciate its arguments more fully and to enjoy Patton's many detailed accounts from the field. The book will obviously be important for anyone studying Myanmar and Southeast Asian Buddhism, but will also appeal to those interested in possession, healing rituals, Burmese resistance to colonial rule, and the marginalization of religious groups perceived to be in possession of secret esoteric powers. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Today I'm with Thomas Patton, Assistant Professor in the Department of Asian and International Studies at the City University of Hong Kong. We're going to be talking about his recent book, The Buddha's Wizards, Magic, Protection, and Healing in Burmese Buddhism, which is published by Columbia University Press in 2018. So hello there, Tom, and thanks very much for taking the time today to chat with me about your book.
Thanks so much, Luke. Thanks for inviting me to be on this today.
So I want to begin, as I always do, by asking you how you came to the study of Buddhism, the study of religion, and specifically the study of Myanmar.
Oh, sure. When I was undergraduate, I was majoring in religious studies, and there weren't too many courses offered on Buddhism. So it was mostly courses on Christianity, Judaism, and during the senior year of my undergraduate, I went on the well-known Antioch Study Buddhist Studies Abroad program. I'm sure you know well. And sure. When I was there, it was immersed ourselves into Buddhist philosophy, anthropology, history, meditation. And it was from there I really got a good solid foundation in just basic Buddhist studies stuff. And the best part, though, from there was when we got to go and do our 1 month independent research, during the month of November. So we were there and I decided, I wanted to go to Thailand originally I had this idea that I wanted to be a forest monk. I read all about the forest monks and I was a young man and I just wanted to hang out in the forest and gain enlightenment. I mean, I was a young man just really throwing myself into it. Hardcore. But then I was in Delhi to go to get a visa. I can't remember. It was all so foggy. This was back in 1999. And I remember like the embassy being closed or something. But then I saw Buddhist monks standing outside and I said, hello, are you from Thailand? They're like, no, we're from Burma. And I was like, Burma? I was like, what's that, Bhutan? I was like, they're like, no, Myanmar. And I was like, Madagascar? I was like, I had no idea what they were talking about. And I was like, but you're Theravada, right? And they said, oh yeah, we're Theravada. And I said, I was thinking about becoming a monk and going to Thailand. And they said, no, come with us to our country. You can stay at our monastery. Our head teacher is this famous monk. He'll take care of your visa and everything. So sure enough, I mean, one thing led to another. They helped me get the visa and the introduction letter. And next thing I knew, I was on my way to Yangon. So I flew into Yangon and went up to Mandalay and Sagaing and ordained temporarily for a month there. And while I did my independent research for the Antioch Buddhist Studies program. And when I eventually ended up going back to the States, finished up my undergraduate degree and said, I think I want to do a little bit more study in religion, world religion. So I entered the Harvard Divinity School. And while I was there, it was kind of expensive to live in the apartments in Cambridge. And I didn't want to take out too many loans because I already had a bunch of undergraduate loans. So I heard that there was a Burmese monastery temple in this part of town outside of Boston in Malden, Massachusetts. So I went there, started hanging out with the monks, and I asked them, I said, hey, can I be your kapiya? So kapiya is this Pali word, which means like the temple boy. So I was going to, I asked to be their temple attendant. So they said, this might work out well. So I ended up, driving them to dentist appointments, doctor's appointments, taking their car in to get serviced. And then I'd go to school in the day and come back at night. And since their English wasn't that great, I had to really learn Burmese. And so I learned Burmese just to be the temple attendant. And then, so I did that for 2 years while at the Divinity School. And then afterwards, I got my master's and really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So I worked in one of the libraries in town for about 2-3 years. And then I realized, I think I want to do a PhD. So I applied to various places and decided that Cornell University had a really good Asian studies, religious studies, and Burmese studies program. So I applied and went there. And so that's pretty much, in a nutshell, how I got to, you know, studying Buddhism, religious studies, and more, you know, Myanmar very specifically.
Yes, yeah, no, that's a great story. Temple boy in Boston. So how then did you come to focus specifically on the topic of this book, namely these ways Buddhist wizards within Burmese Buddhism in the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, totally by chance. I applied to my PhD program. I wanted to do a historical ethnographic study on the Tilashin, or the Buddhist nuns in the country, Myanmar. And then I was also a bit interested in Vinaya, so the monastic code. So I was kind of playing around with a bunch of things. And when I was ordained in 1999, I heard about these wizards. There was the monks that I was living with who spoke English, they actually used the word wizards. And I was like, what? You know, and at that age, I was like, no, that, you know, when I had a very, puritanical idea of what Buddhism was. And I said, no, that can't be Buddhism. They must not be real Buddhists or not real Buddhist monks. So I just kind of didn't think anything of them. But then, as I talk about in the book, in the introduction, I was just horribly, horribly sick one evening, you know, with my Burmese language tutor. And I was just, I mean, it was some of the sickest I've been in my life, and just this horrible fever and vomiting and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I just, that night.
This is in Burma, right?
This is in Burma. Yeah, right, I was in Mandalay, and I was doing research and learning language, and it was just, I got just hit with something. I didn't know what it was at the time, but I'll just tell you the story. It's my language instructor didn't know what to do with me. So he propped me up on the back of his motorbike and said, you know, okay, your home is too far. It was too many miles away. I was stupid enough. I didn't bring my passport with me that night. And so he said, okay, well, my father, you can stay in his place. And, but I was like, ooh, you know, it's kind of sensitive, because at that time, and even now a little bit, foreigners were not allowed to stay in local people's homes. They had to be registered or stay in hotels or government run hostels. And so he's like, don't worry, my father has some, you know, unfortunately he's becoming senile. He's got some paranoia issues. He's completely created this, his home in like this compound, so that nobody can get in or out, and you'll be safe there. So at first, the parents did not want me to stay there. They were convinced that I was a CIA spy that had befriended their son to somehow do some, you know, undercover operative work in the country. And they said, it's true. I've seen it in movies before. And I was just groaning. I was like, just please, dear God, just let me sleep here tonight. And so they eventually put me somewhere, and I won't go into the rest of the story, but eventually I got out of the compound early the next morning, scampered away. The only place that was open that early in the morning was a local Buddhist temple monastic area with a pagoda nearby, where people had already begun congregating before dawn to make offerings, to meditate, to pray, etc. So I said, okay, I'll just sit up in meditation posture and lean against the wall and just wait till the public transport is up and running and I can get back home. And next thing I knew, I fell asleep and I woke up just totally disoriented, completely alone, wishing I was anywhere but Myanmar at that moment doing research. And I looked down on my book bag and someone had placed a little, what I thought was a laminated prayer card. You know, it looks like something like in Catholicism, a little prayer card with a saint on the front. And I was like, what the heck is this? And so I looked on the back, and on the back was a little, kind of like a little spell for healing, which was written on the back in Burmese in a bunch of Pali verses. And so I just decided, oh, I'm just checking myself into a hospital. So I went there, and as I got better, I ended up having dengue fever, which they found out. And during my stay in the hospital, I, you know, took out that prayer card and I was asking the doctors and nurses, I was like, what is this? Who is this? And then one of the doctors was like, you know, how do you say this in your language? He's kind of like a wizard. And I was like, oh, these Buddhist wizards I keep hearing about. So from then on, it was just, I was like, I just became fascinated by these Buddhist wizards. And that's what I decided to make that the central study of my dissertation.
Great. I mean, we're going to talk about what these wizards are in more detail later in the interview, but can you give us a brief outline or explanation of what these wizards or Weza are? What sort of figures they are?
So, I mean, this Weza, this wizard figure, it can be male or female, but almost always male. I mean, females do have the capacity of becoming a Weza. But a Weza refers to any human being. It could be a monk, a nun, a layperson, a hermit, who undergoes some kind of transformation through the use of meditation, alchemy, ingesting sacred diagrams, Kabbalistic squares, engaging in creations of runes, or, you know, also these spells, these magical diagrams, so that the manipulation, the creation, the use of these somehow has this transformative effect on the person, so that he or she gains all sorts of powers, supernatural powers, powers of flight, of longevity, of healing, of walking through walls, tunneling through the earth, conjuring an army of soldiers that he can use for whatever means. So it doesn't necessarily refer to like a certain vocation in life. So a wizard doesn't just have to be a monk, or it doesn't just refer to a layperson. It's more of a mastery in some kind of esoteric lore. And, you know, Weza actually comes from the Pali Vidya, which is from the Sanskrit Vidya. So meaning, you know, it could be wisdom, you know, especially higher order of wisdom or even esoteric wisdom. And so Weza is actually the shortened form, the Burmese pronunciation of the shortened form Wezadara, Vijadara, which means, can, in the dictionary, it's like caster of spells or master of spells, esoteric wisdom. So it's that kind of character that I talk about in this book.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, and what one of the things that you note is that while Buddhist monks are generally perceived as being morally upright, or at least if they're misbehaving monks, they're still part of the Sangha, so they sort of are representatives of that which is morally right. Wezas are sort of a more morally ambiguous character. Mm. So how is this the case? Mm. I mean, because on the one hand, a monk can be a wizard, but as a separate category, how is there this sort of moral ambiguity?
That's a really good question. It comes into, because there are different grades of Weza. So like in, for example, Lord of the Rings, there's different gradations of the wizard. There's Gandalf the White, Gandalf the Grey, and maybe there's another, I don't know, a lower one. But this Weza phenomenon within Myanmar, there are higher order wizards, middle order, and lower order. And all three of these levels of wizards all engage in the same types of practices, or they engage in similar exercises for the manipulation, creation, and mastery of certain esoteric lore. And so, but some, like on the lower end of the ladder, tend to use their powers for more worldly gains, which isn't necessarily bad, but they could use it, for example, to put curses on people or to make people fall in love with others, or to trick someone into doing something that they don't want to do on their own. And then there's the middling wizards who kind of are in this, you know, they're kind of like the gray wizards or the gray Jedi. You know, again, looking at, you know, Star Wars Jedi, there's the dark side, the light side, and then there's those Jedi in the middle who are kind of, you know, dabbling a little bit in each of the powers of the light and the dark. But these wizards can also draw upon these powers for more nefarious means or for more, higher order spiritual means. And then the higher Waitza, the ones that, you know, I talk about in this book, are those who use these practices for the sole purpose of, you know, for good things, you know, healing people, helping people to uncover lost items or lost people, protecting Buddhism from decaying, for keeping the Buddhist institution solid during times of possible deterioration. So the public, when they, you know, hear the word Waitza, they tend to take all three of these Waitza types and kind of not mix them together, but they are aware that the spectrum of Waitza can fluctuate from the higher order to the lower order. So that's the ambiguity of these wizards is both good and bad in the development of the Waitza phenomenon in Myanmar. On the negative side, there's been a lot of, and we'll probably touch on this later on in the interview, there's been lots of government oppression because there's a lot of fear that these wizards might use their powers to try to wrest power from the government, for example. But then by being this kind of ambiguous figure, they can work on the margins of society. For example, a monk who might be following the Vinaya very strictly, might be, you know, a Vipassana, hardcore Vipassana meditator, Vipassana, like, you know, mindfulness, insight meditation, and be a very good, upstanding moral monk, but yet engage in this kind of these other activities that kind of puts him on the outside of his monastic community, the lay community, but that yet he's also seen as a source of great power by to which many people can go to for help. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, does that answer the question?
No, that's a very clear answer on it. So, right. So I guess Waitza, their power can be used for, you know, casting, you know, evil spells, figuring out winning lottery numbers, or, you know,
exactly
furthering one's, you know, oneself, you know, on the Buddhist soteriological path or something. So
yeah, exactly. Perfect.
So most listeners will be familiar with the sort of the ideal relation, Buddhism's ideal of the relationship between the laity and the monastic. And so, you know, where there's a symbiotic relationship. In the case of the Waitza, if that's what's the relationship between the devotee and the wizard? I mean, how do the two interact? And is there some element of reciprocity there in the same way that there is in this sort of symbiotic sort of sangha laity relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple things. First, what's interesting is that, let's say you have a layperson who's a Waitza, he might have followers of monks. So you'll have this layperson Waitza who's teaching a bunch of monks, you know, how to traverse the wizard path. This layperson might give teachings to these monks, which is, you know, in Myanmar, I mean, the monks are such strong sources of power. They're the ones who are usually doing the teachings. They're the ones who sit higher up on chairs. They have special place and privilege within their society. So to have a layperson and sometimes even a female Waitza or trainee, someone who is recognized as having some power garnered from the way from traversing the Waitza path, she might have a follower of a vast bunch of followers, and some of them might be monks and nuns. So that's one interesting about that relationship. But about the, you know, the Waitsa proper and his devotee, the Waitsa can be both a flesh and blood person who's actually living right now as we speak, or the Waitsa, what's also special about them, which makes them Waitsa, is upon their death, they can either, there's two ways that a Waitsa can die. They can die a Shintwet, the Burmese, or a Thetwet. So a Shintwet is when they completely disappear. You know, they just poof. They just disappear. Their whole body and spirit just go out, and they are able, through the magical powers that they've accumulated, and they're able to place themselves somewhere in another part of the world, another dimension, another place that humans cannot, are, don't have access to, but yet these Waitsa live in with a bunch of other groups of Waitsa and intercede on the behalf of humans when they are in need. Or the other form of, you know, dying as a Waitsa is they, the, you know, as we would see anyone else die, their physical body disappears, but their spirit, I know, again, in Buddhism, we said, well, how, there is no spirit in Buddhism. You know, there is no soul, apparently. But yet there is the spirit that leaves the body, which then lives somewhere in another dimension, another portal, another area of, you know, the universe, that also can intercede on the behalf of humans. And both these types of wizards, upon death, appear to their devotees in visions, you know, in, you know, sounds, by providing signs or omens to their devotees. So there's that, you know, upon death, these Waitsa can still interact with their devotees, but also the ones, you know, the physical flesh and blood still living Waitsas can also, they interact with them on a daily basis, like any other spiritual teacher would with their devotees.
Mm-hmm. So you note that although the Waitsa like figures can be seen in materials that are supposed to be datable to as early as the first century CE, the Waitsa figure that's you're really looking at in this book doesn't emerge till the 19th century, and so I wanted to ask about the historical context in which this particular, in which the wizard sort of, you know, emerges. Why did this particular religious figure become so important in the 19th century?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, and I think others would support me on this, it's things really started to change, of course, during the British colonization of the country. Before then, there were all sorts of these, you know, religious medicine men, you know, using all sorts of Waitsa technology, you know, Waitsa technology of alchemy, of meditation, spells, diagrams. But they, it wasn't, nothing was quite institutionalized, or, you know, it wasn't as widespread, institutionalized, and as, you know, was it a solid phenomenon that became much towards the end of the 1800s and then really into the 1900s sort of British colonization. So, and one of the main time periods when we really begin to see a change is during, you know, the 1930s, when there was this one very popular charismatic individual called Seah San, who through his, you know, charisma, through his know-how of how to gain people to follow his cause against the British, he amassed a very, you know, a small army of people that, and he would, of, you know, many villages or Burmese people who were against the British colonization and also against, you know, higher taxes and injustices that they saw were being perpetrated by the British against them. And they felt that, you know, the Buddhist religion was deteriorating. You know, the British were not doing a good job, like the previous Buddhist king did until he was deposed, the British just weren't doing as good a job of protecting the sasana. The sasana is, you know, the Buddhist teachings and institutions that support Buddhism in the country. They felt that, you know, it was the end of times. You know, the Christian British were coming in, the community, their country was falling apart, the Buddhism was falling apart. So it was during this time when, especially Sayasan and other medicine men who were traveling the country and who were drawing on this Weza lore to kind of fill a vacuum that was created upon the dissolution of the monarchy, and to try to create some kind of counterattack that would dispel the British from their country. Mm. And so one of them is Sayasan, and his group engaged in lots of similar activities that we see with the Weita even nowadays. I mean, they had certain engaged with certain magical diagrams that they believed would unlock supernatural powers that they could use to repel the British forces. And that, of course, failed. And the Weitza began to be somewhat oppressed and suppressed by the British forces after that. But really, upon the exit of the British forces and the Japanese forces from the country after World War II, all these stories really begin circulating about specific charismatic Weitza who were very powerful, courageous, and did much to fight back against the British forces and even the Japanese forces. So really in the late 40s, we begin to see the creation of monthly magazines that were published on a monthly basis about the Weitza that were disseminated across the country. Books began being published. Certain assemblies, congregations, associations, semi-secret associations devoted to specific wizards and their teachings and their specific practices began to grow up, began to develop. People from all walks of life began joining these associations. So it was really around this time, the middle of the 20th century, when we began to see the real kind of institutionalization of the Weitza phenomenon. And from there, it kind of morphed into what we know of the Weitza phenomenon today.
Great. So I want to move on now to a specific Weitza whom you mentioned, who's by far the most popular, or according to your book, the most popular Weitza in Burma, and that's Boming Guang. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
But, Boming Guang. Uh-huh.
And he lived from 1885 to 1952. And, you know, in a fascinating chapter about this figure, you explore the way in which he came to prominence. You discuss his posthumous career, which is, it's really after his death that most of his devotees sort of encounter him through dreams or whatnot. And you also discuss the ways in which his devotees interact with him. So who exactly was this man, and how did he come to be such a revered Weitza?
And actually, this is the Weitza who was on that little prayer card, laminated prayer card that somebody dropped on my book bag at the beginning of this, the story that I tell at the beginning of the book and at the beginning of this interview. And he wasn't a monk. You know, I assumed that when I first saw him, I was like, oh, he's not a monk. You know, I also thought, oh, you know, anybody of this power and stature, he must surely be a monk. But then when I started hearing stories, even from monks tell me about their amazing sights and visions and experiences that they had of this layperson, that was something I really wanted to look into more. So yeah, like you said, he was somebody who lived about, 1885 and died in 1952. And he really came to prominence again during the period I just talked about, during World War II. He was somebody whose, a lot of his stories that are his miraculous stories that are associated and attributed to him really come about during episodes involved with, you know, specific events during World War II. So, for example, he is said to be able to foresee when Japanese bombers would drop bombs in this area of Myanmar where he and some of his followers were living. So he would go out on the rocky ledge of this, you know, hilly area, and he would start doing wacky things like flapping his arms like a bird, or he would go out and start, you know, eating food and letting the crumbs crumble all over the place. And people took that as a sign that, oh, something's happening. Something must be up. So, you know, maybe we should do something, you know, go inside, take cover, seek shelter. And they would say, sure enough, a few minutes, hours, or even days later, sure enough, the bombs came. So a lot of these stories, I mean, when I was reading them or coming across these miraculous stories, I didn't see them as too amazing. You know, one of the most amazing stories, for example, was him using a stick to magically turn on a car that had been broken down on the side of the road for years. And then people love telling that story. And I was like, huh? And then another guy would be like, oh, but what about the story of him putting the train back on the train tracks when it went off the rails? And I was like, uh-huh. And so, but it's really interesting. As I started to read about, you know, this time period and read other historians who are writing about the technological advancement of, you know, this period in the late, you know, the 40s and 50s and during and right after World War II, it really was this major influx of technology. And so the Weza began seeing things like the telegraph or the steam engine or bombs or, you know, this that they saw as awe-inspiring, wondrous, something coming from foreign lands, but yet their wizards could control all of it. You know, when a Western technological advancement like a train or a car broke down or went off a car track, their wizard could make it better again with their magical Buddhist power. When they were in danger by these bombers flying across them, their wizard could foresee it and tell them what to do. So it was, but this, what's really also interesting is this wizard, as I write in the book, I mean, if I had to diagnose him, I would say he had some major psychological issues. He would speak in tongues. He would defecate in the open. He would fling his feces at people. He would expose his genitals to people. And interviews of his devotees say that, you know, some of them say, well, you know, yeah, he was a bit crazy, but there was, you know, wisdom in his madness, kind of like mm-hmm. those who were familiar with divine madness or crazy wisdom from other religious traditions actually said it could be that. Others who were a bit more cynical said, well, he happened to live with he lived with a family who were very good at manipulating him and creating a cult around him. So you know, he was, unfortunately, he was somebody who really did suffer from psychological disorders and yet was manipulated by a family who knew that they could get lots of money and resources and followers if they, you know, did their part.
Right.
And so it was this individual, even while he was still alive, had lots of followers and even had a magazine published monthly from 1948 to 1952 until his death. So he was already quite popular then, but he really came to prominence and is arguably the second most revered figure in the country after the Buddha. In years following, when people began to have dreams of him, when he started to show up in other magazines and more stories began to be attributed to him after he died. Because one of the main reasons that Weza can still act in the world upon death is because they're not reborn. They don't take rebirth. They go to another dimension from there, from which they can then intercede on the behalf of humanity.
Mm-hmm. But a quick question, because in the case of Booming Guan, it sounds like all the lore around him and all this, I mean, the whole image of him and the figure and, you know, this, the figure, sort of the image of him, although it begins to take shape during his life, it really takes off and continues to develop it and sort of comes into sort of a mature development after his death. I mean, how representative is this of Wade Tse more generally?
Another great question.
Is it common that this is a type of religious figure whose sort of prominence and importance usually is developed, after the death?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it could be actually attributed to non-Wade Tse religious figures in the country as well.
Yes.
People are always looking out for the next saint. Whether living or dead. And when they're dead, it's much more easy to attribute all sorts of things to that saint. You know, like you mentioned, winning lottery numbers. You know, they're like, oh, that saint appeared to me in a dream. Guillaume Rosenberg, he writes quite a bit about these kinds of things in his work about the power of the saint and these kinds of things. So that would be another, if listeners are interested, it'd be good to read his work as well. But a lot of them, there are other very famous Wade Tse, Yakansin Taunciato, who I write about in the book, who's become very popular after the fact. There's another now one who's having he's becoming quite popular throughout internationally right now in, you know, 2018, 2019. He is the Burmese name is Bopauk Sainciato, which means like he's the abbot of, axes, like, you know, axes where you cut down trees. So his story was he became popular after a story started circulating that he was arrested by Japanese officers during the Japanese colonial era. And they were going to interrogate him and his arms were tied behind his back. And then he miraculously, through his magical powers, made two axes appear in the sky that began, swinging and swinging through the sky. And they cut the cords, the binds that was tying his hands together. And then he was able to, be free. And so then he became, Mr. Axe Wizard. And this axe, like an image of the axe, has become a symbol of protection, power, luck throughout the country. And during, the past, decade or so, there's been this also increased popularity in Buddhist amulets, especially in Thailand and coming out of Thailand. And so it just through various connections that I won't get into now, this monk, this wizard, Mr. Axe Wizard, and his axe amulets became very popular amongst collectors and Buddhists in Thailand and Singapore, who then started wearing these amulets and then began attributing their luck and success and protection and health to this amulet. And they wanted to find out where it came from. So then they started going to Yangon, where this monk who died in the 50s or 60s still had a monastery. And when I went there in the past, it was always kind of, run down. But recently I went back there a couple months ago, and thanks to massive amounts of money being pumped in from devotees from Thailand, Singapore, Taiwan, and other parts of mainland China. The place is, it's amazing what they've done to it. I mean, there's multi-storied structures on the compound premises. So you begin to see these kinds of things happen, after the death, if their stories and their power can be attributed to such things as, luck and power and health and healing. And then they go on to have international fame, which then makes them even more popular back in Myanmar, because they say, wow, if, international people think that this saint is worthy of respect, then maybe we should look into it even more.
Sure. So moving on a bit, in the third chapter of the book, you discuss possession of certain people, mainly women, by Wade Tse. And you provide a number of fascinating and really actually very moving accounts of such possession that you witnessed during your field work. I mean, I should mention that for listeners that this whole book is, I mean, it's theoretically rich, but it's also, and you know, you consult historical documents, but you know, it's very ethnographic.
Thank you.
And so I just want to ask you how this possession, well, you say this possession is different from other sorts of possession that we find in Burmese religious life, and different from the possession that most people in religious studies would think of when they hear the word possession. So sort of what is the sort of nature, character of this possession of these women by Waitza?
Yeah. So what was really striking about, you know, these especially young women that came into this power by being possessed by Waitza, usually were young women in their teens, early 20s, who were facing or had just had really life altering experiences. You know, they lived through abuse, being forced to marry someone they didn't want to, you know, in-laws who are especially vicious to them. So I didn't notice it at the time, only after the fact, after I looked over my notes of interviewing and visiting with and watching dozens of female Waitza devotee mediums, did I then make this connection. And this is very similar to what other anthropologists have found amongst, you know, young women, especially in Southeast Asia, who undergo similar transformations in their societies when confronted with life-altering challenges and stressors in their lives. But for these wizard possessions, these is a bit different than, let's say, other kinds of possessions in the country, in Myanmar. So many of your listeners might be familiar with gnats. Gnats are other spirits which can or cannot be part of the Buddhist pantheon, depending on, you know, who you speak to in the country. And another scholar, Benedict Braque de Lepierre, has written extensively on the gnat and gnat spirit possession. You know, she's done at least 3 decades on this, so I would highly recommend looking at her work as well. But these Waitza possessed encounters, these experiences tend to be more less ecstatic. So for example, the gnat experiences of possession tend to be more ecstatic. They tend to be more experiences where the person being possessed or channeling the spirit might not be entirely conscious of what's happening to him or her during the experience, or that person who's being possessed by, or who is channeling the gnat, the guardian spirits, might have to engage in some preliminary activity involving, let's say, maybe alcohol, or, you know, to work themselves up into some kind of trance-like state through which then the spirit can enter into that person. It's a bit slightly different in the Waitza case, whereas these, especially young women, they usually have some kind of initial encounter early on that somehow has a trigger that opens up, that primes them, that indicates to them and their family that they are ripe for being possessed, or they are now vessels for channeling the spirit. So one way is, you know, they may have been very good, you know, quote, they may have been being very good Buddhists throughout their when they were younger. They may have, you know, said their prayers diligently. They may have been, you know, very upstanding moral individuals in their community. They may have made donations to monks in the past. So perfecting their, you know, their parami, their virtue for extended periods of time, then makes them more receptive to the Waitza coming to visit them. And then the Waitza will appear to them, enter into them for, you know, certain periods of time, anywhere from, you know, a few months to a few years, some say maybe for, you know, almost a whole lifetime. And they, you know, they use this, the possession
the mediumship of these Waitse to then channel that power of the Waitse, who might not be able to do it themselves. You know, there's always the understanding that these Waitse, if they can, and there are instances in the devotees' reports that the Waitses, either in flesh and blood or in kind of apparitional state, have actually helped individuals. But another major way for them to actually enact change and help people physically, such through as to heal specific ailments, is to actually enter into a Waitse devotee. Then they, like a puppet who's pulling the strings, are then able to manipulate the hands, the speech, the body of the devotee to do what the Waitse wants. But then when the Waitse leaves, the power is still housed within that devotee.
Mm.
So whereas, like, say, in the gnat possession, from the best that I know of, that power only resides in that person during periods when that gnat actually resides in that person's body.
Yeah.
But here in the Waitse, even after the Waitse leave for, you know, after leaving for that, you know, how, until the person comes back, until the Waitse comes back, that person still has the power of the Waitse to still heal people, to give advice. So that's what makes it a little bit different. And again, I would really look into Benedict's work, and she, because she puts it much more eloquently than I do.
So one of the things you discuss is the importance of pagodas within the world of Waitse and Waitse devotees. And in fact, you begin this discussion with a story about a Burmese monk who builds a pagoda on a farm in New York State in 1958, after he had been instructed to build pagodas outside of Myanmar by Bo Ming Guan. And I mean, of course, pagodas are extremely important in Burmese Buddhism more broadly, but why are they so important for Waitse? What's their role here?
Mm. Yeah, that's something that I was also on the lookout for during my research, but Waitse devotees kept saying, oh, why don't you go to this pagoda, and we started visiting. I mean, pagodas in general are extremely central to Buddhism in Myanmar, but I began to see that there was stylistic differences in pagodas associated with the Waitse versus the kind of pagodas that you find throughout the country. And I found out that they were important for a few reasons. One is they're considered, I mean, again, drawing upon new technological advancements that were coming from outside the country that we talked about early on in the interview, the Waitse and the Waitse devotees were talking about these pagodas in ways that they likened to an antenna or a Wi-Fi hotspot, or some kind of communication beacon through which they can access another dimension or world where the Waitse are residing. And these pagodas are ways in which the Waitse, who, you know, if they decide not to interact with humans in the flesh and blood, can send messages, you know, visions, thoughts, anything, revelations through these pagodas, which will then, interact with the devotees who are in the vicinity of the pagodas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pagodas as well, associated with the Waitse, are often referred to as Kodnawin pagodas. So Kodnawin can mean, usually translated as 9 cubits. So cubit is an ancient length of measurement, which usually roughly corresponds to, you know, about a forearm's length. And so, I mean, it gets into crazy mathematical symbolism here. So the number 9 is very important to the Waitse phenomenon, because the number 9 is also associated with a very important gatha, or, you know, sacred verse associated with the 9 qualities of the Buddha. Otherwise, some of your listeners might know it as the Iti Piso gatha. So that chanting that gatha or inscribing the words of the gatha onto an amulet, onto a piece of paper, onto a candle, onto your body as a tattoo or something has great protective powers. So if you can use the number, the powers associated with the Iti Piso or the number 9 and use it and kind of use it as a blueprint to create a certain pagoda, that pagoda will have amazing protective qualities attributed to it. Mm. And one of the ways they do that is by creating that pagoda, the dimensions, the measurements of the pagodas in factors of 9. So many of these Kono-in 9-cubit pagodas really are 9 feet high, or they might be 18 feet high. So 18, you're like, well, yeah, I guess 9 times 2 is 18. But really, you take the integers 1 plus 8 equals 9. Or you might have 27 feet high Kono-in pagoda. So 7 plus 2 is 9. And 9 is has another, I mean, going on 9 again, 9 also is considered a very mystical number within the Weiza tradition, because that number, when it just dominates, it just equals success. Any number, I forget, I wrote in the book, I completely forget it now because I'm not a mathematician, something like every number, you take the number 9, multiply it by any number, then divide by 9, always equals 9 or some number whose integers add up to 9. So the 9 is just this number that dominates. It's associated with success, power. So you see the number 9 being central to the ways of phenomenon in general. And that's one of the reasons why, and sorry to go on, but you went again to another question you asked about to the early 20th century about how the ways of phenomenon became so popular, you know, during the British colonial era. There was this belief that because of this magical association with the number 9, its dominance and its power, there was this great movement amongst Weiza devotees and associations to create these Kono-in pagoda all over the country. They believed that these pagodas, if created throughout the country, would have this effect that would just repel the British. It would somehow get them to move out. It would expel them. So you see peppered throughout the country these Kono-in pagodas popping up all over the place. Many are in disrepair. But there's been this movement in the past decade to either repair many of these pagodas or to create some new ones, like this monk who in 1958 was sent by Bomingao himself to go. Oh, sorry, 1958, Bomingao had already died, but it was while Bomingao was still alive, it entreated this monk to go far and wide to build these Kono-in pagodas wherever he went. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that I actually found this very interesting, too, that the Weiza were, in some sense, they were like a lot of other groups during the British colonial period, that they were kind of fighting against, British rule and sort of trying to protect this sasana that they saw as being in decline. Mm. But, of course, they did it in their own Weiza-like way. So,
yeah, you're right. So it was like... I talk about how, you know, when they were so concerned about the sasana deteriorating under their watch and while the British were ruling, but then, you know, the British left, they gained independence. In the 1950s, there was this renewed revival in the Buddhist sasana which coincided with the supposed, you know, 2,500 year halfway mark of the Buddhist sasana. So there was this idea that, okay, you know, we're in control of our own country again, our destiny, our own Buddhism. So at this point, there was less concern with building pagodas, engaging in Weiza activity, other Buddhist kind of activity in repelling the British, but more in stabilizing the Buddhism that they had. And then slowly in the second half of the 20th century was really about pushing it out, propagating it. I mean, the army, the Sangha, lay people, engage in a massive pagoda building and just general Buddhist propaganda
exercise in trying to spread Buddhism far and wide, whether in the country or definitely in other parts of the world, mm-hmm. to really kind of solidify the sasana, to make sure that, okay, it was under threat, we stabilized it, and now let's really keep it, you know, really spread it far wide so that, you know, if it happens to die out in another part of the world, it will still be strong in another part of the world, and we can keep it lasting for as long as we can.
Great. So we're getting close to the interview, getting close to the end, but I did want to ask something about sort of Waitsa sort of self-perception. I mean, you point out that the Waitsa, despite their popularity or perhaps because of their popularity, have been persecuted and maligned. You mentioned this earlier in the interview. And many of the Burmese Buddhists with whom you spoke who weren't Waitsa devotees told you that what you were researching wasn't really Buddhism and that you'd be better off focusing in on a topic such as Vipassana or meditation or Abhidhamma or something. So in some sense, that's not really so surprising, right? But what was surprising for me was that many of the Waitsa devotees you interviewed also said you should downplay the role of Waitsa in Burmese Buddhism, instead emphasize things like meditation and Buddhist philosophy. So why this apparently self-effacing attitude on the part of Waitsa devotees? I mean, do they really think that they're simply engaging in frivolous superstition, as some of them suggested to you?
Oh wow, another great question. I mean, they themselves did not think they were engaging in any kind of superstitious activity. Mm-hmm. And even the governments and the monastic authorities that were trying to suppress them or tried to disband their associations or practices also didn't believe they were engaging in superstitious activity. They were all in quite the opposite. They all believed that they were engaging in very powerful activities that could have, you know, very important consequences, either good or bad, depending on what side you were on. But they were also very aware of their place in the international world. So, for example, one of the main ways that a foreigner could enter the country, you know, through the 1980s and 90s and even through, you know, the 2000s until very recently, and stay for long periods of time, was only through getting a meditation visa. So if you wanted to be a tourist, you could, you know, stay for 28 days, or maybe if you were lucky to get a business visa, you could stay for a bit longer. But if you could get a you would go to the Burmese consulate and apply for a meditation visa, and you could stay for months and months. And then you may stay, you know, become temporarily ordained. So the Burmese were very aware that one of the major exports of their country was Vipassana meditation. They would send many missionary monks throughout the United States and Europe and, South America as well, to, you know, missionize via Vipassana, and which was very good. And that would bring in lots of, you know, meditating tourists back into the country. And so they were very aware that the kind of Buddhism that the world was interested in was, you know, Vipassana, something that was quite different than the Waitsa, you know, what we find in the Waitsa tradition. So they were very aware of that. And while they themselves didn't believe that they were engaging in anything superstitious, they were afraid that, let's say, my readers or my students or people I talked about, they would somehow think negatively of the Burmese Buddhists and their country, because they would be like, you know, you Westerners are not familiar with these kinds of things. You know, we don't want you to look on us as crazy or wacky. So, you know, it's best just to downplay those things. And also, I was doing this research in a time when there was lots of when things like now with Facebook is in the country. So there's, you know, since 2013, there's been this cultural, political change happening in the country where people are much freer. But, you know, in the 1990s and 2000s, when I was doing this research, people were still being spied on by the government. It was in their best interest to downplay their activities in groups like Waitsa groups that were being monitored by government authorities and spies. So it was a couple reasons. So, you know, again, how they were seen by outsiders and also how they were seen by insiders. And they didn't want to bring any more unnecessary attention to themselves by a foreign researcher.
Sure. So we've taken a lot of your time, and, you know, I should remind listeners that there are many just really wonderful firsthand accounts of, you know, various things you encountered during your field work that we didn't even touch upon in this interview. But as a final question, I wanted to ask if there's anything that you're currently working on now that this book is out.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm getting older, I'm finding out that field work is not as enjoyable as it used to be. I don't enjoy being sick all the time. I don't enjoy, I'm just old. I'm becoming too old and pampered, and I don't like being away for so long. So this next project, I'll still bring in some ethnographic components, but I'm really now interested in looking at these spells. So I've amassed a very large collection of Weza spell books, which include all sorts of diagrams and verses, ways of gaining supernatural powers. So, it's similar to going to Hogwarts and going to their library and pulling down, you know, all these magical spell books. So I've got, you know, the Buddhist Weza equivalent just sitting here in my office that I need to get through. And there's some fascinating spells that are just waiting to be translated. And so, and, you know, and discussed I think that's what I'm working on now. I'm translating a bunch of spell books. I'm learning more. I mean, while doing my research, I actually did apprentice myself to an actual spell master who taught me how to, unlock the power of these spells. And I've been trying for years and years and nothing has happened. I have absolutely no magical powers. I can't fly. I can't walk on water. I can't tell winning lottery numbers. My mother-in-law thinks I can. And she just recently bought a lottery ticket and asked me to touch it. And also, you know, use some of my weights of magic to hopefully help her win, but nothing like that. But I'm just, so that's my next project, looking at a lot of these, something more where I don't have to be in the country so often, and I can, you know, do the work from the comfort of my office and still be around my family and not have to be away for so long. But I imagine my third project will then be more, you know, I'd like to go back into the field and do another project, maybe specifically about Bomingown. I'd like to do eventually, you know, just kind of addressing a lot of the questions you asked me in this interview. You know, what is it about this guy? You know, why him? Why that time period? What made him so special? Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things I'm thinking about on the horizon.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to a second and eventually third book. So, all right. Well, thanks again for taking the time to speak with me today. That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.